Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 285. Welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Trullo. I serve as pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And with me via Zoom once again is Rob McKenzie. Hey, Rob, how's it going?
It's good. It's good. You know, the
is it
nuclear-powered really? Moat frogs are, you know, keeping they're doing their job, keeping people away from the house.
The nuclear-powered moat frogs. Yeah.
Well, yeah,
sure.
You have to have something to protect your house, and the turrets that I put at the top of the house just weren't enough. So
yes, anything in those turrets to like defend the house?
radioactive squid.
Yeah, radioactive squid. Oh, okay.
Yep. Just shoot those puppies right out.
Puppies? Yeah. You're a killer of puppies? Tippy, careful.
No. Yeah. Don't say the word puppy and then look at the raptor of a dog you have and try to make a comparison.
All right. So,
what? It's like, Tippy, put down the mailman.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, you know, I should say that we, a couple episodes ago, I mentioned that there was a very incriminating picture that was sent to me. From a listener, a friend of ours, and he was concerned that given the embarrassment that it gave you if we were still friends.
If you and I were still friends?
Yeah, if we were still friends.
We are, but he should be concerned.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Oh, he will be. He will be, actually.
I love you, man. You're very fun to talk to, brother. Now, I'm not talking to you, Rob. I'm talking to the guy that's listening.
Oh, I know. No, trust me.
So I know he's going to be at work doing something. He's going to do something like, right about now.
Yes, that is probably true.
Yeah. No, good guy. So. Really appreciate him.
But yes, right. You want to jump right in.
I think I do. Yeah. So last time we started a conversation, which 50 minutes in, we were still just talking about preliminary things. And, so we decided to call things to a close that we would, do another episode to, open up, John MacArthur's, remnant of, Zechariah 14 and talk a little bit about, John MacArthur's understanding of Zechariah 14, I think, right?
Right. Well, in the first episode, we did discuss a lot about hermeneutics and how we both approach. And I think that's important. And to understand that foundation, now that we're getting into the actual text of what's being said and the theology that John MacArthur or dispensationalism is going to derive, and then, of course, what covenant theology and amillennialism is going to derive from our side, I think that's very helpful to already have that done.
Yeah, of course. So let's see. Shall I read Zechariah 14? Or did you want to read it?
Yeah.
You want me to read it? Okay.
No, I'm too good. Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Now, we should say as well, he doesn't deal with the whole, right, in detail of Zechariah 14, 1 through 20, 1 through 21, sorry.
Right.
He starts at 1, but the major focus, if I remember correctly, is 9 through, was it 9 through 11? Is that accurate? Am I thinking of that correctly? I'll read the whole thing, but there is.
Yeah, he does actually talk about the whole passage, but you're right that there's more of an emphasis in that middle part. But he does talk about the whole passage.
You're right. Okay, so this is Zechariah 14, beginning at verse 1. We'll read through the whole chapter here now. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and houses plundered, and the women raped. Half of the city shall go out into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. On that day, his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by very wide valley, so that one half of the mount shall move northward and the other half southward. And you shall flee to the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach to Ezal. And you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. On that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost, and there shall be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light. On that day living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern side and half of them to the western sea, to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea. It shall continue in summer as in winter. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day the Lord will be one, and his name one. The whole land shall be turned into a plain, from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem shall remain aloft on its site, from the gate of Benjamin to the place of the former gate, to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's winepresses. And it shall be inhabited, for there shall never again be a decree of utter destruction. Jerusalem shall dwell in security. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the peoples that wage war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. And on that day, a great panic from the Lord shall fall on them, so that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of the one will be raised against the hand of the other. Even Judah will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be collected, gold, silver, and garments in great abundance. And a plague like this plague shall fall on the horses, the mules, the camels, the donkeys, and whatever beasts may be in those camps. Then everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths. And if any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if the family of Egypt does not go up and present themselves, then on them there shall be no rain. There shall be the plague with which the Lord afflicts the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. This shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. And on that day there shall be inscribed on the bells of the horses, "Holy to the Lord." And the pots in the house of the Lord shall be on the bowls before the altar. And every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holy to the Lord of hosts, so that all who sacrifice may come and take of them, and boil the meat of the sacrifice in them. And there shall no longer be a traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. All right, so that's Zechariah 14, 1 through 21. So, Rob, as best as you're able, can you summarize, help us to understand as honestly as we can be to get a sense of what John MacArthur, how he understands this passage, what he's bringing out of this passage that is unique, that dispensationalists, how they read this text?
Yeah. So this is what's going on here from a dispensational perspective is that this is at the end of the tribulation period. So you've had the rapture, which takes out the church. And just after the rapture, at some point, the rise of the Antichrist. So it's really when the Antichrist actually comes out. The 7 years actually starts maybe when he – it's differing opinion within dispensationalism. Some say the rapture happens and then 7 years later is the end of the tribulation. Others say that it has to be when the Antichrist makes a covenant with Israel. But regardless, we have the seven-year tribulation period, and it's at the very end. The first 3.5 years are bad. The last 3.5 years are much worse. And at the end of these 7 years, you have every nation. And John MacArthur was very specific about this. Every single nation. This is one of the times that he said something that you kind of mentioned in our last episode, where he goes, how do we know it was every nation? Or how many nations? It says right there, every nation. And, it's kind of funny. And I hopefully our listeners understand that, like, I'm not, and you're not, we're not mad at John MacArthur. We're not upset that he did this. I kind of raise my eyebrows about some of the ways that he does these things or that he says these things. I raise my eyebrows when he says that all millennialists are foolish. I don't think that's right. I don't think as a pastor he should be doing that. But it doesn't upset me or anything because I'm confident in what I believe. It's just kind of, I don't know, it's just kind of funny. But so the end of the tribulation period, and for a dispensational eschatological system, this is actually Revelation 19. So they're saying that this is in the same as Revelation 19, the same time period. And so all the armies of the earth are coming and they're going to wage war against Israel. And the thing about it is that in the Battle of Armageddon, and MacArthur was very clear about this, that Israel actually is attacked, that these armies do attack Israel and they take the city of Jerusalem. And they kill 2/3 of the Jews, which is, you wouldn't think. I think that often we hear the Battle of Armageddon, that Christ comes back and then destroys all the armies, that there is no actual battle, but there is a battle and the Jews are losing. And they, in fact, they've kind of lost. And so again, 2/3 of the people are killed, Jerusalem is taken, and then all of a sudden, the sun, the moon, the stars, those that are left, because this is already after 7 years tribulation, and like 1/3 of the stars were cast out of heaven into earth. So they're already gone. Lights are already diminished. The moon is already turned to blood. And the lights are dimmed and there's darkness. And out of that darkness comes Christ riding on a white horse with the sword coming out of his mouth. And behind him are all the saints riding on horses. And as he comes back, and as the light of his glory is what is now going to light the earth. And so that's what we see coming out of darkness. It's a really inspirational scene. If you think about it, this darkness, and then all of a sudden this burst of light, almost like a Gandalf with Helm's Deep, where Gandalf comes over the ridge and, boom, there comes the army to save them. And, Christ, he sends confusion to the soldiers and the text, their horses, they are confused. They stop, and Christ just wipes them out, to the point where they melt. That's talking about where their insides melt and they're dead. So they're all dead. And, in fact, he says that it's going to take 7 months to bury the dead. Because there's that many. There's so many that are dead, it takes 7 months to actually bury them all. So that's the Battle of Armageddon from a dispensational viewpoint. So it's at this point, so the now Christ has wiped out everyone. He talked about where this valley is created, where these mountains are split in two. Actually, Jerusalem, as we know, is kind of set up on a hill, but Jerusalem actually ends up, because of the changes within the typology, it actually ends up on this plain. It like gets lowered, and so there's this giant plain all around, and with this valley, that has opened up between these two mountains because they were split in two. And Jews now, because not all Jews were in Jerusalem, so all the Jews from all the world come back through this valley. They come to Jerusalem, and there's a river that will flow from Jerusalem and end up filling this valley with this clean, living water. This really clear water, and it's refreshing water, and that's going to happen. And Christ then, this is going to about to go into the millennial kingdom. So the temple is rebuilt. The throne of David is set up in Jerusalem. Christ takes his seat on the throne, and the millennium begins. And the curse itself, which the curse that happened after the fall, which affected the entire universe, the majority of the curse is actually pulled back. The earth itself has this kind of revitalization. So it's kind of like the whole earth becomes like almost like the Garden of Eden. Now, don't take that literally, and I mean that. They're not saying literally it's the Garden of Eden, but they're just saying that it's just lush, and they're all over the world is very fertile, and but because the curse itself has been pulled, not completely, but the majority of it has been pulled back. And the glorified saints, which when we came back, everyone, the church came back with Christ, and we're going to reign with him and he'll talk about this in the five-part series I heard that he did on the kingdom, which is also available at sermonaudio.com. He talks about how we, as the church, we will rule with him. So if you've been faithful in some things, you're going to get three cities to rule over. And if you're faithful in other things, you get five cities to rule over. And if you're faithful in more, then you get 10 cities to rule from. And that, you know, it's like we're like the seat of government all over the earth. And the Old Testament saints at this point are, they are raised. Anyone that died in the tribulation, they are raised. So at this point, and this is where he gets to the place where scripture talks about how all of Israel will be saved. So now we have Israel set up as Israel. All the other nations have been wiped out. Israel set up, and all of Israel is saved. And that's now going to be 1,000 years of glorious rule. And this is where if a person dies at 100, it's like they died when they were young. Or it talks about how there are no more false prophets. That if it were possible for somebody to arise that was a false prophet, that they would immediately be ashamed, and their parents themselves would kill them. And MacArthur, he's not. He's saying that's if that were possible to happen, but that's not going to happen. There are going to be no more false prophets. He talks about how just think about the world where every television show, every television newscast, every newspaper, every magazine, everything on the internet is gives glory to God. There are no lies on the news. There are no lies in government because it's glorified saints who are ruling and reigning with Christ. So there aren't going to be political scandals because we're glorified. We can't have political scandals. He talks about, we read this in the passage where every year, the whole world is going to come together and to Israel and participate in the Feast of Booths. Of course, the temple is there and sacrifices will be made. Of course, we look at the book of Ezekiel. And even this passage kind of supports that view that there are sacrifices being given. And these are the actual sacrifices from the Levitical, priesthood and the Levitical law code. And Ezekiel's very clear on that. Ezekiel's the language that's being used there in chapters 40 through 48 is referencing back to the Aaronic priesthood and the Aaronic sacrifices that are being given in Israel. And so that's going to be reinstituted. Of course, progressive dispensationalists say that they understand that there is no temple, that we are the temple. And so that there is a portion of dispensationalists that would disagree that there is a temple and that there's going to be sacrifices. But MacArthur is saying, I know he holds to that. He talks about how that because people are going to be living hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, he would say that a lot of people are going to be born there and then live the whole time, all the way to the end, because the environment of the universe, the environment of the earth is so rich and pure, and the curse has mostly been lifted. It's going to be very rare for people to die. People are also, those who are Christians in the tribulation period, who become Christians, enter into the millennial kingdom as humans, unglorified saints. So there is a potential, of course, for them to die because they have mortal bodies, but they also will have children. And because they will live so long, and because life is so fertile, they'll have lots of children, and those children will have children. So that by the end of the millennial kingdom, the whole earth is filled with millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people, maybe probably billions, according to their understanding of what's going to happen. So when, of course, at the beginning of the millennium, an angel comes down with a chain, and he binds Satan with a chain. He opens the bottomless pit. There's a key. There's a door, and he has a key, and he opens the bottomless pit, and he hurls Satan in there, and he locks the door. Satan is bound for 1,000 years, which is why there's no Satan, because it's not just Satan. It's Satan and all of his minions. They all get thrown into the bottomless pit. And so there's no more demonic influence on the earth. You know what? We talk about how we wrestle again, not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities, rulers of the darkness, rulers of the air. That's all going to be gone because Satan and demons will no longer be on the earth. They'll be in the bottomless pit. After the 1,000 years, Satan and his minions are allowed out. They go to the four corners of the earth, and they raise hundreds of millions of people to then rebel again against Christ. And they are easily defeated, and then they are thrown into hell in the lake of fire. And both them, their minions, and then that's when God will raise the dead. Because see, those who are not Christians, those who are not saved, are not raised till the end of the millennium. So everybody that's died, not in faith before the millennium starts, are not raised until after the millennium is over. And then they're raised, judged, and then they're cast into hell. One other thing I'll say about the millennial kingdom for the dispensational point of view that I think is very important is that within the millennial kingdom, if, you know, I talked about the sacrifices being given, the Feast of Booths, having to go to Jerusalem to give worship to Christ. If individuals do not do that, then they are instantly killed. And if nations themselves rebel, so if they say, well, our nation is not going to come up to Israel to worship or to participate, God will send plagues into those nations and withhold the rain. So they'll have plagues, they won't have rain, and many of them will just die. Because God will kill them instantly.
Hey, can I interrupt you at that point,
Rob? But of
course,
why would people do that? Knowing that that's going to happen. Yeah.
Well, how would, in your understanding of dispensationalism, how would in this millennial kingdom, how would there be this evil rebellion without the presence of demons, spiritual entities and powers, because they're cast down in hell. And you said these are glorified people, but only Israel? Only Israel is in a glorified estate? So where's this evil coming from and the nation? Millennium, how is this? Help me out.
Let me correct a couple things for you, because I know I went fast. It's when the tribulation period is over, when the battle of Armageddon is over, when the millennium is beginning, all Christians from all ages, all of God's people have been raised and are glorified. And the church, who have all been glorified, are reigning throughout the earth as Christ's ambassadors. Of course, Christ is reigning in Israel. the people that live through the tribulation period enter the millennial kingdom still in their physical bodies.
Okay, thank you.
And because the earth now is so full, oh, so fertile, they're having kids. And so there's hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people on the earth at the end of the millennium because so many people have. Yes.
And, well, that's true not only of the Christians, but also those unbelievers who entered the millennium at the end of the tribulation as well. So they
no,
don't.
Unbelievers, the unbelievers, no unbeliever enters the millennium. They are killed.
I'm sorry. I thought you just said, though, that everyone at the end of the tribulation that was at the end of the tribulation enters into the millennium.
No, the believers enter into the millennium. The unbelievers are all destroyed by God. God kills all unbelievers, and they are not raised again until after the millennium is over. So this is how we enter into the millennial kingdom with only saved people, only okay. Christians, or only what we, yeah, only Christians are in the millennial kingdom. They are either glorified saints or they are people in physical bodies who have lived through the tribulation period.
Okay.
So this is how when Scripture talks about all of Israel will be saved, that's because every Jew that's there, that are all living in Israel now, are all Christians. They're all redeemed. So now that can be literally fulfilled, saying that all of Israel will be saved.
That brings us to another thing. Does that mean every ethnic Jewish person throughout history? Or that doesn't mean that, does it?
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, I've often wanted to ask that of a dispensationalist, that if all means all, and we have to take this literally, shouldn't the phrase "all Israel will be saved" mean that every Jew of all time should be saved? Because all Israel will be saved. But their response is no, that it's talking about a very specific time period. And that is the beginning of the millennial kingdom.
Okay.
That now you look at Israel and everyone in Israel is a Christian or a follower of God. That's how they're interpreting it.
Yeah. And these are people who have put their faith in Jesus Christ. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because you qualified, yes, you said accurate. Christian, you said or follower of God. So I just.
No, I the only reason why I hesitate to say Christian is because but they are Christians. My only hesitation is just thinking back to some of the language that dispensationalists have used in the past. But the majority of them have no problem saying that. Yeah, they'll be Christians. They're all Christians, and they're all the citizens of Israel. All the Jewish citizens are all Christians, and that's how they can say all of Israel has been saved. Or okay. is
and,
saved.
And this doesn't include non-ethnic Jewish people.
It doesn't include non-ethnic Jewish people that are living in Jerusalem or in Israel. But there are non-Jewish people that are Christians that live through the tribulation period that enter into the millennial kingdom. Peoples from every tribe and tongue and nation.
Yeah.
So, if you want to ask more clarifying questions, that's fine. But I think that's pretty much the layout of what MacArthur's talking about. If you want, we can go back now and talk about some of the problems I see that I think dispensationalists have to deal with.
Yeah,
need more for clarification.
He said a lot more, right? He did it fast. He recognized that it was 7 minutes of a lot of information,
right?
Of walking verse right. by verse of saying, and this was what this means, and this is what this means, and referring to things in a historical way. The mountain is going to be right. Torn in two, and there's going to be this, and it's going to be over there. It's going to be over here. This is how it's going to be situated. He did all that. So yeah. what are some of your issues with MacArthur's interpretation here?
Well, it starts with his actual interpretation within the passage, his own hermeneutic. He keeps emphasizing how we have to take this literally. And it talks about, like he'll say, and all the Jews from the four corners of the earth are going to come to Jerusalem. And he'll say, how do we know that all the Jews from the four corners of the earth? Because the passage says all Jews from the four corners. So he's trying to make that, you know, that emphasis. Of,
right. And he gets a like giggle from saying, the crowd too.
He's not reading this. He does. Yeah. He does. And actually, yeah. And Arthur's got good comedic timing. And I say that with all respect, actually. He really does. He's funny. He can be very funny, which is a sign of intelligence. And so, yeah, but the problem actually comes in when he talks about the horses, where he's so emphatic about we have to take this literally. And if you don't take it literally, you're actually interpreting in a foolish way. And then he gets to the horses and he actually says, now we know that the horses are symbolic of weaponry and power. And it's like, no, you can't do that.
I don't remember. Did he use the language of symbolic?
You can't sit here and tell us how everything has to be. Yeah. Okay. Well, he said they were of – it was symbol. I think he said symbolizing.
Yeah. I remember him saying something like horses. Like whatever they're mechanizing – whatever mechanized weaponry they have or something like that. So, yeah. I'm sorry. I interrupted again. Go ahead.
Well, he said that they're symbolic of military might, power. Mm-hmm. That's okay. No, he says that the horses, he says it's obviously symbolizes military might, power, weapons. And so where the text says that the people and the horses are confused. And okay, well, they're cast in this confusion. Well, how can machinery become confused? I mean, if it says horses, then it should be, his interpretation should be horses. I just think that's a very, it's very inconsistent.
Yeah.
In other places it talks about the tents of Judah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, cause I remember him also referencing Jesus coming in and riding on a horse, right? So why wouldn't Jesus be coming in on a tank mm-hmm. then if a horse symbolizes weaponry. And I don't mean to be flippant there. I'm trying to be consistent with
if he says
horses are symbolic of military might and strength, whatever the and Jesus comes in riding on the white horse, as you said, with the sword coming out of his mouth, if they understand that literally, then why wouldn't you interpret them the same way, that it is of might and power and whatever the particular machination of mm-hmm. power and might is at that particular time in history is what will be mm-hmm. What will be used for the Battle of Armageddon. Well, why wouldn't that be the case for Christ as well? I guess is a question that I would have.
No, it's a good question. Of course, for MacArthur, I'm not going to answer that for MacArthur. I'm not exactly sure what he'd say.
I'm not looking for answers.
He does say that Christ comes in on a horse, and that's a very dispensational thing. Yeah, yeah, I think it's a good question. It's like the all the people of Israel are in tents. The whole city of Jerusalem is, at the time of the writing, lots and lots of people lived in tents. It was a very common thing to do. And you can say, well, these are soldiers that are living in tents, but the problem is that it's the city of Jerusalem that's being surrounded. This is not the army of Israel's gone out in their, like the two tents, the two side, two armies are in their tents before they come out to battle. This is the city of Jerusalem. It's just, as soon as you, as an interpreter, deviate from not only how you're interpreting, but how you've criticized other people for interpreting, it's inconsistent. And I think that the reason why he does it is because he realizes it is very obvious that these people are not literally on horses. But if this was 1830, wouldn't they be on horses? Now, I've heard plenty of dispensational sermons throughout the years that actually did say that these are horses. So, you know, all dispensationalists, they don't have a problem by saying that these are horses. And I've even, you know, remember people talking about how that there's citing, I think it was the Chinese that still use horses in their military or something like that. And that's fine, whether they do or not. Majority of people don't. And this is, you know, every nation has a Senate and army, and the majority of them are not going to have horses. They're going to be on tanks or jeeps or airplanes or drones or something like that. It's just an inconsistency. And I think that I could probably hear some dispensationalists saying, oh, well, that's a small thing. But it shows that, you know, I guess my question is, why is he allowed to use allegorical interpretation, symbolic interpretation, but we're not? I think that's a legitimate question. Another problem in this is that when Christ comes back, so all this happens. And one thing, I'll just say this as a side note, he makes a big deal out of the day for the Lord and the day of the Lord as two separate things. I've never heard that from a dispensationalist before. Now that I just might have glossed over it in all my reading. Because even in the end, MacArthur himself says that the day for the Lord is encompassed over, like an overarching of the day of the Lord. So I'm not sure why he made such a big deal about that. But when all this happens, the day of the Lord or the day for the Lord, whatever you want to say it, it happens quickly. And all the dead are raised, the earth is transformed, this is all happening. However, after the Battle of Armageddon, we're told, and MacArthur talks about this, that it takes 7 months to bury the dead. Well, dispensationalists are very keen on chronology. So the day of the Lord comes, and then there's the millennial kingdom. Well, so what happens? What is everybody doing in those 7 months? I mean, Christ comes back, all the dead in Christ are raised, the earth is transformed, the throne is set up, we're ready to start the millennial kingdom, but now we have to wait for 7 months while the dead are being buried? Christ, who has come from heaven and killed millions of soldiers, which, of course, we know God can do very easily and quickly.
Yeah.
But it's going to take 7 months to bury? It's an inconsistency with his chronology, with the dispensational chronology. It's inconsistency, and they have to account for that. What's happening? Why is there 7 months? Well, so they could bury the dead. Well, but I thought Christ comes back and then the millennial kingdom starts. There it's just an inconsistency. And, you know, the way that we're looking at this passage, the way that from a reform perspective, knowing that this is apocalyptic language, we listen to how are the people that the original hearers, how are they hearing this? The language that's being used is maybe, you know, over the top language, where the idea of an army being wiped out and then taking 7 months to bury tells us how large that army was. The weight of power against Israel, and of course we are going to look at the New Testament and see how we should understand Israel, the people of God. The weight of the opposition against the people of God is huge. But of course, in the end, Christ is the one that delivers us or deliver. Yeah, I looked up. It's interesting because I looked up Calvin. He did write a commentary on this book and to see what he had to say about this passage.
Yeah.
And he looked at this and said that this is talking about Israel. It's talking about the Jews, but that it's about Israel and what will happen up until the time of Christ. Mm-hmm. And he does make notes of, now he's not looking at a chrono, you know, the what's going to happen, but it, you know, it's symbolic. This is just, and he talks about Antiochus Epiphany and the horrors that come from that. And, but he says there are people that say that this is talking about 70 AD. There are people that interpret this and say that this is actually talking about not up until the second coming. So he does talk about what we would understand as, you know, Reformed interpretations, and that there's varying different interpretations. I just thought it'd be interesting to see what Calvin had to say, because Calvin's often accused of not talking about eschatology.
I don't think that's a good.
So going into them, go ahead.
I was just saying, I don't think that's a good assessment of Calvin. First of all,
interpretation.
I don't think that's an good understanding of Calvin, that he doesn't talk about eschatology.
Of
that's all. But of course you're going to have different, I mean, just as you do in dispensationalism, you do have difference about details among those who are covenant, Reformed theology, covenant theology, about the details of various things. But in general, you're going to have basic similar frameworks about what's going on. Like I was just, you know, looking at some people are, you know, talking about, well, you know, the restoration of Feast of Booths is during the period of the Restoration, right? So you have the reason you have, you know, sort of a lot of sort of historical sites being referenced here is because some of these prophecies are about the immediate moment, the historical context, but then they also refer to something beyond that immediate fulfillment. So that's another way of looking at it as well, that there's an immediate fulfillment and then there's a fulfillment beyond. Sometimes it's spoken of as the, actually I can't think of the exact phrasing of it, but when you have like a mountain in front of another mountain and you look at them and
prophetic
you see,
prophetic
perspective. When you look at a mountain range from a distance, it looks like it's just one large mountain, but when you get you get closer and closer, you get on the one fulfillment of that first mountain. Then you see there's multiple mountains behind it, and you can see a variety of different ways in which the same statement can have different fulfillments as those things come about, and that might include 70 AD, right? But in that day, like with regard to Zechariah here, most always has a final fulfillment in the day of the Lord that is spoken of throughout the prophets in various ways, as well as by the apostles.
Yeah. So other problems with what's going on here is, so we enter into the Millennial Kingdom, and this is actually Kim Ritterbarger of the White Horse Inn fame and pastor, who had been a dispensationalist all the way up, I think, past college, then became Reformed. What really did it for him as far as bringing him out of dispensationalism into the Reformed world was the idea of evil in the Millennial Age. If you remember, I talked about, or MacArthur talked about, just how wonderful everything's going to be, and you know, no sickness, and people, if somebody were to die when they were 100, it's like a child dying, and all these things, and that's definitely something that dispensationalists hold to. But there's several, I would say, contradictory problems going on in the life in the Millennial Kingdom, such as at the end of the Battle of Armageddon, when Christ comes back. So here's the second coming, is all the nations are destroyed. And yet in the Millennial Kingdom, the nations are back. And all these nations that God wiped out are now alive and well in the Millennial Kingdom. Well, wait a minute. Even, you know, we're told that Gog and Magog are in at the end, or in the Millennial Kingdom. Well, wait a minute. Gog and Magog were destroyed at the second coming. How are they back? MacArthur talks about how if somebody sins and does not bring offering, that they'll melt. They'll be instantly killed. If a nation rebels against the rule of Christ, he will withhold the rain and he will send a plague. And if, of course, there's people in there who are sinning and not coming to the offering, they're going to all be killed. There's an emphasis within dispensationalism, within the Millennial Kingdom, of swift, instantaneous justice. That God is going to kill, you know, those who rebel against him. But at the end, when Satan is released, and he's able to gather hundreds of millions of people to rebel against Christ. How is it possible that there's hundreds of millions of people who are rebellious against Christ that can go through the motions for several hundred years? Christ, God knows our hearts. And he desires you know, true worship, not actual sacrifices. So I just think it's inconsistency that you have this rebellion at the end of a place that is supposed to be so free of sin and rebellion. Because that's the other thing is when it comes to people sinning in the millennial kingdom is, you know, we sin in our heart. And so if we, and we also sin by commission and omission, we sin often when we don't realize we're sinning, right? Aren't there sins? Job talks about this. God would not strike me dead for an unknown sin. He would not, or not judge, like, he would not treat me like this, not bring judgment on me for an unknown sin. But in the millennial kingdom, sin is dealt with quickly, swiftly. So it wouldn't every single person be sinning in ways that they wouldn't even know, that they don't confess. Right, so wouldn't they be instantly?
Because even though this is the millennium, this is not a situation where people are sinless, or they are, or mm-hmm. they're dead. Right, they have to be sinless because they're glorified, or they're dead. Right. I mean, I'm trying to.
They're glorified, or they're well. Again, those people who live as Christians through the millennial, through the tribulation period,
yeah,
enter the millennial kingdom in physical bodies.
Right. But if they sin, they die. So that's what you said, right?
Lots of people within the millennial kingdom. Yes. Right. Yeah. That's yeah. Exactly.
And now, and so this so is why saying, I you're saying
I actually have yeah.
Sorry. Our video streaming sounds here are making us go over each other at times. So you're saying that's an inconsistency, right? How can the nations rise up again in rebellion? Mm-hmm. This is actually what I was trying to get at when I asked the question a while ago about mm-hmm. evil and such. How is it that there can be mm-hmm. nations that would come against Christ if there is this mm-hmm. sense of no patience, that there's immediate retribution and strict justice, that when one thinks sin at all, there's immediate punishment. So that's what you're saying,
right?
MacArthur not only suggested but stated, and therefore there's inconsistency mm-hmm. within this. And you said Riddlebarger saw this as a great inconsistency, and this is what drove him to reassess dispensationalism. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So the last issue I want to bring up that I think that dispensationalists have with the millennial kingdom, because I'm holding them to their own hermeneutic. They're looking at this as a completely literal hermeneutic. It says 1,000 years, it has to be 1,000 years. They have to account for the 7 months that they're burying the dead. They need to account for that. I don't think that can work. The Christ comes back, millennial kingdom starts, but the 7 months messes things up. At the end of the millennium, so Christ reigns for 1,000 years. At the end of the millennium, Satan is unbound and released, and he goes into the nations and stirs up all these millions of people that are now going to rebel. The problem is that it's not like he does that instantaneously. No, it might only take a few months. Let's say it takes a year. But Christ, the millennial kingdom is for 1,000 years. And at the end of the 1,000 years is when Satan is released. So either you have to say that the kingdom ends and then there's this time of Satan and then his rebellion is put down, or you actually, even a dispensationalist, cannot take the millennial kingdom as a literal 1,000 years. I don't think they can. There's the 7 months at the beginning, and there's an unspecified amount of time at the end that they cannot fit into the millennial kingdom. Being if it's only 1,000 years, if it's only 1,000 years, then it has to end the very day that Satan is released, and then he doesn't have time to go gather people. Or it has to continue while he's, which is more consistent with the dispensational view, that the kingdom is happening when Satan is out there trying to influence people. And because it's happening, then it's still going. It's past the 1,000 years. It's in overtime. And because they're so insistent that 1,000 years, 1,000 years, 1,000 years, I'm looking at them saying, 1,000 years plus? It's not literal.
Hmm. So you're saying there's an overlap of the ages, so to speak, there, of the millennial kingdom and of Satan's influence at the end of the millennial kingdom. There's an overlap that takes place. Sorry.
it's almost like an age to come is overlapping into the age that is.
Oh, wow. Interesting. I don't want to take that too far in there because I wouldn't want to put words in their mouth. But it sounds like, Rob, it sounds as though we haven't finished what we wanted to start.
Yeah. We haven't.
And I think we got to come back.
So a third episode?
I think we got to come back for a third episode. I hope you've been enjoying this because, yeah, we're coming back to another episode. Thanks for taking the time to be with us on this episode, discussing these things and hearing about Zechariah 14 from John MacArthur's perspective and trying to get assess that just a little bit. Lord willing, we'll have a bit more of that and a positive assessment, not assessment, sorry, a positive statement with regard to Zechariah 14 in our next episode. And Lord willing, after that, we'll get back to Berkhof. So here we go, thinking about what's happening next.
Back to Berkhof.
Yeah, back to Berkhof. So again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. You know, we are a podcast of Reform Forum. Go to reformforum.org. Check out all the wonderful resources that are there. Also, do check us out online at westminsteropc.org. Find out more about the congregation that Rob and I serve. But you might be interested in other OP congregations throughout Chicagoland, and you can go to chicagoreformed.org to do that. And so you know what's up next time. And again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.